This is Car Expert.
Tesla has already come out and said that they're going down the path of removing radar and not even considering LiDAR in their vehicles, which I just think is absolutely crazy.
Funny enough, my mum had one of the first WRXs when I was at school.
I think it was the sound of a whole legion of old school car enthusiasts rolling their eyes. You won't buy a sports car because of the infotainment system.
G'day, I'm Mandy Turner, and hello, Paul Marrick.
Mandy, hello.
And William Stopford, hello.
Hello, Mandy.
Now, we've got a bit of a Japanese sports car feel theme to this week's podcast, so we just may as well start it off now. The Integra name is coming back, Will, which is really, really cool.
Yes, so it's a little bit unexpected, to be honest. Honda's luxury division in the US, Acura, which also sells cars in markets like China, they announced that they were ending production of the NSX, but with a special Type S model. It's a little bit more powerful, a little bit lighter, etc. But they're also rolling out Type S versions of other models in its lineup. So it seems like they're chasing a little bit of a sportier bent than they have been over the years. And then they dropped this teaser of a headlight with Integra written underneath it.
Oh.
So they have confirmed that a compact premium entrant is coming to the Acura range in 2022, and it will be called the Integra. Now, that is not to say that this is going to be some wild, high-revving Type R. I mean, fingers crossed, it's something at least anywhere close to being that exciting. But Acura currently sells a model called the ILX, which is based on – it's like two Civic generations old. It's just their kind of little small – premium sedan, and it doesn't sell all that well. So I think that they've gone to kind of dust off an old nameplate and try to bring themselves back to relevance in that segment. It's actually a kind of a funny reversal because Acura in the 90s got rid of the Legend nameplate, even though it had huge name recognition, because they said, oh no, but you know, we want to bolster our brand nameplate here. So if we rename the Legend to the RL, then people will have to say I drive an Acura RL. So then more people will hear the name Acura, because people knew Legend and they weren't really necessarily associating it with Acura. So that's how that story goes. And so obviously this is a bit of a reversal, you know, 25 years later or so. So let's see what this Integra looks like. With Acura rolling out these Type S versions, it could actually be something a little bit special. I dare say it's probably going to be a sedan and not a coupe, although it fortunately isn't a crossover wearing an old passenger car nameplate like the Ford Puma and the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross, etc. But I will just manage your expectations now. I don't think it would come here. It will likely be built in the US, which means it will likely only be built in left-hand drive, which means that even Japan might actually miss out on it.
Oh, wow.
So,
and look, like kicking the teeth.
Japan, actually, surprisingly, they miss out on it. You'd think, you know, Japanese brands would sell all of their products in their home market, but like Japan doesn't even get the Infiniti Q60. Like they just miss out on random things sometimes. So look, let's see, but they've said that they're introducing it next year, so we won't have to wait long. But yeah, that's nice to see an old nameplate come back.
Yeah, I don't know. Honda isn't really doing anything interesting lately, and seeing how they're traveling at the moment, it wouldn't surprise me if it's something boring and not all that interesting. So I'm not going to hold my breath.
I think from memory, the TLX Type S has debuted with a twin turbo V6 from memory.
Okay.
So they seem to be trying a little bit harder to be exciting, but unfortunately, it just comes down to the we miss out on all the exciting stuff. And you can say the same thing about we miss out on turbocharged Mazdas like the Mazda 3 and CX-30, 2.5 turbo. We miss out on turbocharged Subarus. You know, we tend to just miss out on all of the juicy stuff here.
Hey, Paul, which nameplate would you like to see make a return?
SS Commodore.
Not surprised?
Yeah, it'd require an LS3 and a V8, so unless you're going to give that to me, I'm not interested.
Good answer. What about you, Will?
I don't know. I don't know.
Something you have to think about.
Anything that would be brought back would probably be a very different beast. If they were to dust off the Commodore nameplate, it would probably be on something electric. So, yeah. And anything that gets brought back is probably going to be quite a bit different.
God, could you imagine an electric Commodore? Oh, boy.
I drove one of those once. An Australian company, what were they called? I can't remember. They basically built a prototype, and it was an electric Commodore. It was a VE Series 2 at the time, and I think it was a wagon from memory. Fully electric, though, with a swappable battery.
Oh, cool. How did that drive?
Yeah, it was okay. Nothing spectacular. Okay. Yeah, it was all right. Better than a kick in the pants.
Let's start this week's news off with probably the biggest news for this week and maybe quite a few months or maybe even the year. Paul, 2023 Nissan Z's being confirmed for Australia. Hallelujah.
Yes, yay, party poppers, all that sort of stuff. I kind of feel like the Z is what the Supra should have been. And the reason I say that is because they've launched it with a 6-speed manual or a 9-speed automatic if you tire easily. But the 6-speed manual comes with a mechanical limited slip diff. It's got a carbon composite drive shaft. It's a proper twin turbo V6 petrol engine. It makes 298 kilowatts of power, 475 newton meters of torque. It looks like it's an absolute beast. And, of course, the news is that it is coming to Australia, which I think is great. We don't know pricing yet, but I suspect it'll probably be around the $60,000 mark, I would have thought, maybe a little bit more. But, yeah, what do you guys reckon about the design? It looks literally the same as the prototype.
So, so happy about that. I actually love the rear. Was that 90s 300SX?
They specifically said it was inspired by that generation of 300ZX, which is great to see a company be inspired by a 90s design. Like, it's almost enough time has passed for us to start.
Absolutely. But I can't find any angle wrong with this car. I don't know about you, Will.
I just, for me, the front grille is a little bit too rectangular, but that's kind of splitting hairs. I mean, how often do you see a car go from concept or proto to production with so few changes? I mean, maybe Subaru should take some notes.
Yeah, they show you the prototype and they go, okay, delete that drawing and let's just start again.
I feel like, though, with the grill that you were saying, Will, that it could be like the giant BMW kidney grill that once you put a rego plate or especially like a Euro plate or whatever across it, it'll break it up a bit.
Oh, look, I think I complained about the M3 and M4 grill and then now I love it. I think they look fantastic, so whatever.
That's troubling. The interesting thing is, though, it's not on a brand new platform. So it basically carries over from the 370. And I think that's fascinating because it looks brand new. To the untrained eye, this is a completely ground up brand new car. But they've kind of taken parts from the whole sort of Nissan range. And I think it really works. It's not a car that looks like they've just thrown together with what was left. There was a lot of hype around it, and I'm confident it'll be good. I just hope it sounds good because the 350 and the 370Z just sounded terrible. They just sounded literally like a Nissan Murano. They really were not interesting at all. So I really hope they've just dialed a little bit of noise into that exhaust. I think the manual can come with a sports exhaust or something like that.
Surely people are going to modify them anyway. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
As a former Supra owner, Paul, would you buy one of these?
Yes, until I saw the infotainment system. It just looks... Yeah, it just doesn't look great. Like, it's great for Nissan because it's the best of a bad situation. But for me, if I was to own one, I would tire very quickly of just not having a decent infotainment system. But potentially, I don't know, I'll wait till I drive one first. But I think I'd love a manual. I think a manual one would be really cool. So TBC.
Sorry, I just heard something. I think it was the sound of a whole legion of old school car enthusiasts rolling their eyes because you won't buy a sports car because of the infotainment system.
Very good. Yes, I know.
Oh, God. Will, what do you think the price might be? I saw in some of the comments on the story that some people might think it might be priced around the Supra range, 80 to 90 grand.
That's what I would expect. Maybe slightly less than that, but
that's a lot.
It's certainly going to be more expensive than the 370Z. But of course, the 370Z has been around for like a millennium
since the 90s.
I don't understand who is actually still buying a 370Z when so it's changed so little over the years. Well, we should not just buy a used one, but
I saw a 370Z, the Nismo, the other day with new registration plates on it, and I thought, wow, that's desperate purchase.
Actually, another 370Z I saw on the road the other day was a black one, and a lady in her probably late 30s getting out of it, she was a cleaner. She was picking the mop, the bucket, everything out of this car.
That is so weird. Maybe it was the son or the daughter's car or something. That's so weird.
Very, very odd. Next on the news story, Will, the Mercedes-Benz C-Class all-terrain estate ruled out for Australia. Why do we miss out on wagons?
Because we don't buy them, Mandy, unfortunately. You and me Paul and other enthusiasts just aren't enough to sustain the continued availability of wagons here, which is really unfortunate because I think, especially the C-Class all-terrain, it has what people want from an SUV. It looks slightly more rugged. It rides slightly higher. It's got some vague semblance of off-road capability. And yet it's still, I guess, Mercedes thinks that it's just wouldn't sell as well as a GLC. And people would think it's just, it's just a wagon. I'm not going to get that. So we can wax lyrical about wagons until we're red in the face, but unfortunately people just aren't buying them. It's really unfortunate. And Mercedes-Benz has said as much. So they have said, demand for our growing family of Mercedes-Benz SUV models continues to increase while demand for estate models is steadily decreasing. So we've missed out on the E-Class all-terrain. We don't get the E-Class estate here. We don't get the second generation CLA shooting brake. So now that the current, like the outgoing C-Class estate will obviously be discontinued, that will leave Mercedes-Benz with no wagons in Australia whatsoever. Which is really sad. Now, if you do love wagons, they're not dead yet. In fact, there's actually one more entry into the segment because we've got the Genesis G70 shooting brake arriving later this year. But there's still the Audi A4 Avant and the BMW 3 Series Touring. And if you like this wagon look with a bit of plastic cladding on it, there's the Audi A4 Allroad, and there's also the new Volvo V60 Cross Country, which replaces the regular V60 wagon.
Do we still get the Passat All-Track?
Yes, we do. The regular Passat wagon. There are still some wagon options out there, but other wagons have disappeared. So Volvo V90 Cross Country recently left the market. A Jaguar XF wagon also left the market. So that there's still options, but not as many as there probably once were. It is unfortunate that we're not getting even the C-Class all-terrain because it actually looks pretty good.
It looks fantastic. I thought it actually looked pretty schmick because the standard one just looks a bit boring, whereas this looks great.
Yeah, and I love the press photos where it's just like storming through a giant puddle and air between it and the road coming on some rocky pass. But so there's not a massive amount of changes under the skin compared to the estate. There's a couple of extra off-road driving modes. There's 40 mil of additional ground clearance. Obviously, it comes standard with all-wheel drive, but it's just the standard 2-litre petrol and diesel mild hybrid four-cylinder engines like the C-Class estate. Look, it is really unfortunate because the more I look at photos of this, you're right, Paul, the estate, it's like, but this looks great. I always thought the E-Class all-terrain looked fantastic as well. So, look, I don't think anybody, I think a lot of the people who listen to our podcast probably are more in the camp of, people should buy more wagons. It's just unfortunately the people out there outside of the enthusiast community who just don't like them and won't buy them. And that's why companies won't bring them here.
It's interesting how maybe not a lot of people know that there are high-rise wagons. Like they obviously assume that most of them are, quite low to the ground. But when you've got like the all-terrains or all-tracks and all those, they ride a little bit higher, but they still look way cooler than an SUV.
And to be fair, plenty of people buy the Subaru Outback. And I know there's no longer a Liberty wagon anymore that's related to it. Mm. But
you look at an Outback, it really does just look like a jacked up wagon. So there's still a market for them out there, but I guess just not big enough of a market for Mercedes-Benz to consider bringing these models here.
Yeah, very true.
A real shame. And you know what? I actually just realized as well that they barely sold any E-Class all-terrains, and the Victorian Police Force is actually using them now as part of the Highway Patrol. So they must have just really wanted to get rid of them for some reason. Wow,
that would look even cooler. Wow. Yeah. Well, speaking of emergency vehicles, Paul, Tesla Autopilot has been crashing into emergency vehicles in the US, and it's finally being put under investigation.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'll explain my thoughts on this in a second, but an investigation was started on Friday of last week with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is a US government body, and they're citing 11 known crashes since 2018 with emergency vehicles where Teslas that were on autopilot or radar cruise control had crashed into emergency vehicles, where 17 people were injured and one person unfortunately died. And according to the NHTSA, most of the incidents took place after dark, and the crash scenes sort of had flashing lights and all that sort of stuff. It's interesting because this is a preliminary investigation. So they're basically now combing through all the evidence. They're looking at all the data. And based on their findings, they will then decide whether they're going to go into a full-on investigation here. And if a full-on investigation finds that there were issues with the vehicles, they can actually force Tesla to make changes to the software or the hardware that takes part in this whole auto-driving venture. My thoughts on this, look, I own a Model 3, and when I have it in autopilot, when we're driving down the freeway or something on a longer distance drive, my hands are always on the wheel because it will randomly brake at shadows. Like we'll be going sort of there's an overpass or something, and it will just suddenly slam the brakes on, thinking we're going to crash into a shadow on the road. Other times it has left the lane because it thought the lane was ending even though it wasn't. So I don't trust the system, and I also don't trust the system enough to fully drive the car because it's absolutely not ready. Tesla has already come out and said that they're going down the path of removing radar and not even considering LiDAR in their vehicles and solely relying on cameras, which I just think is absolutely crazy when you need backup systems, especially when it comes to cars driving themselves.
Did you see that video that was going around on Instagram of the people driving through the cemetery in the Tesla, and the screen kept picking up people, and they were saying, and they were playing spooky music. They were playing spooky music to suggest it was spotting ghosts, but obviously the system just was getting confused by maybe the heat coming off of tombstones or something like that. But it was, I obviously don't believe in ghosts, but it was creeping me out.
That is so funny. I love that.
I'll have to send it to you.
That is crazy. Yes. Please do. Yeah. Look, I mean, to me, we've seen FSD beta, so full self-driving, which is what they call their self-driving technology. They have a beta now in the States that they've allowed select people to sign up to. And the funny thing is most of the people that sign up to this are Tesla fanatics, and they will simply upload videos of how good the system is and it working flawlessly. But you've got a rogue section of the fanatics there that are actually uploading the fails. And some of the fails are so incredibly bad that, I don't, to be honest, I don't consent to being on the road at the same time as these people and having one of these cars veer into me. And it's just really troubling that they're just rolling out these updates constantly that allow people to do this in the States. And I really hope the regulators here in Australia just don't allow this stuff until we know that it works, because at the moment it just looks like it doesn't really work that well.
No, I look forward to an NHTSA report, because with any Tesla story, you've always got a camp of people who are diehard Tesla fans and think, oh, wow, what an amazing innovator. They're rolling out this technology no other company has. It's great. And then you've got other people who are just very quick to say, oh, Tesla's crap. They're going to go bankrupt any second. You know, they can't pull a profit. They're using people as guinea pigs, blah, blah, blah. So it'd be nice to actually get like an objective government report out of this to determine just how effective these systems really are.
Yeah, and that's the thing. For me, I just report it the way that it is, and I know with my car how it works. And to be fair, of all the cars that we test with lane keeping assistance, which is effectively what autopilot is, it's just radar cruise control with a lane keeping assistant, Tesla is the best, so it does the best job at it. But the problem with that is people think that it can drive itself, which it absolutely can't. The NHTSA actually came out and said there are currently no cars on sale today that can drive themselves. And while it is infinitely better than a lot of the other car brands, it's still not good enough to be driven without your full attention.
I think it's a lot of it just comes down to people not understanding that autopilot is an autopilot. Even in planes, there's still a pilot sitting there. They're not sitting in the back seat or in the cabin. And it reminds me of, you know, like people back in the day getting confused about cruise control, that episode of The Simpsons where Bart goes, that's okay, we'll just press the cruise control, and then just sits back and it drives into a cornfield. Like, people just don't understand that these systems. But I don't know if Tesla is actually discouraging people from these incorrect assumptions about the systems, and calling a system full self-driving is ludicrous.
Not helping at all.
Yep.
Nope. Lastly, Will, something you love talking about, Genesis, the 2022 GV60 has been revealed. It's rather a polarizing design.
Yeah, look, I'll be perfectly honest here. This might be the first Genesis design I don't love. Paul, I know you're not a massive fan of the looks of various Genesis.
No, well, I some of them I like. I don't mind the G70. This new one looks completely stupid. Well, not stupid, just not great.
I'm very wondering great. If it's going to be one of those cars, like we were speaking about before, that will just look better in person. But it's Genesis's... Genesis's first ground-up electric vehicle. So they will be introducing an electric version of the G80 sedan and the GV70 next year. But this is based on the EGMP platform, which is Hyundai Motor Group's dedicated ground-up electric vehicle platform. So that means this is related under the skin to the Hyundai Ioniq 5 and the Kia EV6. The EV6 has this very aggressive-looking design language. The Ioniq 5 is angular and retro and cool. And this is kind of blobby.
It's a great word for it.
It's very curvaceous. So all these EGMP cars so far have kind of blurred the line between, like, crossover and large hatchback. I don't know if this one does it quite as convincingly as the others, and also debuting it in this weird kind of funky lime yellowy color is a bit different. But I mean, look, one thing you can say about Genesis is their vehicles always share a common design identity in terms of the split level headlights and tail lights and the crest grille and elements like that. But each car has its very own personality, and this has its very own personality. She's got a nice personality. So basically what Genesis has done is they've just shown us the interior and the exterior. They haven't released any technical specifications yet. In the interior, because they're digital rear view mirrors, the interior is very screen heavy. So you've got like a display on either end of the dashboard that projects the view from the blind spot monitors. And then you've got a large digital instrument cluster and a large touchscreen infotainment system in one big array. It's kind of a similar concept to like the new BMW iX and i4, et cetera, putting it in one big array. But then unlike a German car, you've got this funky interior colorway. As one thing I really love, I really respect Genesis for doing, is having colors in the interior, because you can get that dark green and brown interior in the GV80. I know the GV70, I believe, comes with like a blue interior and like a purplish red. This one they've shown is a blue interior with lime green stitching, and I just realized why it looks so familiar to me. I have a suitcase that looks like this.
That's not good.
I'm like, wait, why does this look so familiar? I do have a suitcase like this. I bought it because it wasn't black, so it would be easier to find when it was coming off the turnstile. So, but everyone buys black suitcases and everyone buys cars with black interiors. So,
easy to find a fluoro green car in the car park.
Well, yeah, God, you might miss this.
Yes, and easier to find the car that's depreciating the most in the car park. Well, can I ask you a question, Will?
Yes.
Do you think it's a problem that if you actually look at all of their cars, none of them really look anything alike? Like this new one they've just released looks nothing like any of their other cars. The G70 that we just published a video on YouTube looks nothing like any of the SUVs. Do you think it's a problem that they all look completely different?
I actually really respect them for doing this, because every car has got a crest-shaped grille. Every car has got split-level headlights and taillights. There is a family resemblance without them looking like, you know, same sausage, different lengths, or whatever the expression is. Like, I found in the past some Audis, I can't tell from a distance which Audi it is. And I find that just, you know, really, really boring. So I think this is quite a refreshing kind of family design language to have. And it means that some of their cars look a little bit more aggressive, like the G70 is probably a little bit more sporty and aggressive looking. And that's what Genesis has said, the smaller the number, the more, like, dynamic and focused it is, whereas the G80 is a little bit more curvaceous. So I really like that. I like that they don't all look like clones of each other, because I find that absolutely tedious. But the GV60, at this point, as I said, they haven't confirmed technical specifications. But if we look over for reference at the Hyundai Ioniq 5, that has, you can get up to 225 kilowatts of power and 605 newton meters in the Ioniq 5 lineup. That's in the dual motor all-wheel drive model with the, I believe, 72.6 kilowatt hour battery. So you're looking at a 0 to 100 time of 5.1 seconds. But the Kia EV6 is going to top that. I don't know if anybody, maybe it's just me that keeps getting these ads sent to me, but every time I'm on like Instagram or somewhere in the net, I'm always getting these Kia EV6 ads, because they've got it lined up with a bunch of other, with a bunch of sports cars for a big drag race. Because the GT EV6 is going to have a 77.4 kilowatt hour battery, dual motor all wheel drive, 430 kilowatts of power, 740 newton meters of torque, and a 0 to 100 time of just 3.5 seconds. Which is great. And it just, I just wish I could just go back in time and tell people, you know, in 1997, you know, at a Kia showroom, looking at a Mentor or a Sportage, hey, you know, eventually.
You'll never believe me, but.
Yeah, exactly. They'd have me committed. So look, we don't know which powertrains are going to be in the GV60 lineup, but given, you know, Genesis' upmarket position within the Hyundai Motor Group family, I dare say the more powerful ones are going to be there. So we'll just have to watch this space. It is coming in the first half of next year. And Genesis is actually introducing 3 electric vehicles all at once in Australia in the first half of next year. So they've said, look, we're not going to bother with hybrids. You can keep them. We're not going to bother with plug-in hybrids. We're going to just jump straight to electric vehicles. And they're following through on that by simultaneously introducing 3 electric vehicles. I don't know how many G80 electrifieds they'll sell. They don't sell that many of the G80, but it's in, you know, not a really huge segment. But something like the GV60 or the GV70 electrified, which we believe is going to be the third EV model from Genesis. I think those could be bigger sellers for the brand, especially when you've got so many buyers out there who are really keen to get into the EV space. They're discovering Genesis. Mm. Obviously, you know, it's still a small brand for now, but they're growing at a rate of knots in terms of their model lineup. So let's see if sales follow that.
Indeed. A very big week in car news. Hit the car news link at carexpert.com.au for more. Well, we also would have been talking about the reveal of the Subaru WRX STI in the news, but it has been delayed this week, the launch of it. So instead, we thought we might get Car Expert's resident racing guy, Chris Atko Atkinson, on to talk about his wish list for his perfect WRX STI. Hello, Atko.
Hi, how are you, Mandy?
Thank you. We're really touching on the Japanese sports cars this week. Now, the legendary Subaru WRX, no stranger to you. Can you tell us about your connection to the car and the brand?
It goes back a fair way now, unfortunately. Now I'm a bit older. I first drove for Subaru back in 2004 for Subaru Australia. But actually, funny enough, my mum had one of the first WRXs when I was at school. And I ran into a guy from school the other day. He works at Red Bull now, but he was an Olympic triathlete. He's actually an ambassador for Subaru as well. And he said, oh, I still remember when your mum used to pick you up in the WRX at school. I'm like, this is like 25 years ago.
Your mum was cool.
Yeah. but the link sort of goes back because my dad raced for Subaru in the mid-80s with the first four-wheel drive. What was it back then? Will might even have a better idea than me.
Tribeca?
No. It almost like a Leone, would it be? It's like
it probably would have been the Leone. I mean, it wouldn't have been the Vortex, would it have?
No. So that was the first sort of four-wheel drive rally car in Australia back in sort of early 80s, 84, 85. So he did the New South Wales Championship in that. So our Subaru connection goes back a fair way. So he ran the Subaru dealer team car back then. And then I raced for Subaru Australia 2004, then joined the World Rally Team 2005, raced for them for 4 years. And then ended up going back to Subaru the last few years in America for Subaru Rally Team USA. So I've had a sort of a long heritage on and off the last 20 years. And for my family, it seems like the last 30 or 40 years with Subaru as well.
Incredible. So we know the teaser this week of the 2022 STI will have a manual transmission. So let's get into your wish list. I'm assuming the manual transmission would be on it. What else do you think it needs?
I'm not as a manual transmission guy as many people would think.
Really?
The rally cars we race are either paddle shift or sequential. So for me to drive a H pattern racing, it's like, oh, God, like I forgot. It's like hard work. And you're trying to heel toe and do all this stuff. So I'm probably too lazy. I think the thing, whether it's manual transmission or not, the thing is it needs to be engaging and like really reactive. So either way, if they're going to go some form of automatic, it needs to be like a dual clutch or something like that. But it needs to be still you're driving the car, you know, you're in control. So that's probably the key. And I don't know whether they've got the technology or the budgets to go that far in where the price point is of the car at the moment. So manual transmission is probably where it's going to stay. And there's no point to have some just sort of sports automatic that doesn't really work properly.
Akko, I was going to say that your alternative is knowing Subaru's other products, a CVT. So just be happy with the manual.
Yeah, we'll just take the manual. Let's not mess it up. So if they've gone that way, that's it's the easy option but the smart option at the same time. But I think like looking at other components of the car, the first WRXs were so cool and so impressive for the price. Like they were almost at that time supercar performance for a sort of mid-range moderate price. Like it was just ridiculous how quick they were. And now everyone's just caught up in it. And I did some research the other day. I was like, the 99 STI, say, was faster 0 to 100 than the current car, you know?
Wow.
It's like as a claim time from Subaru. So 20-something years later, I didn't check, say, like a few years before that, but that's sort of some stats I found quickly online, and it was 3 or 4 tenths quicker than the current car, 0 to 100. It's like there's no evolution, like there's no progression, and that's the car's still good, as we saw in our review against the Yaris. But for me, it needs to be the car that's stepping up now to taking on the A45s of the world, but for a cheaper price. So it needs to be in that whatever price bracket, 55, 60 grand. But taking on the 100 grand cars that are 300 kilowatts and heaps of torque and little rocket ships, because that was what the WRX was back in the day. That's it just stood out above the crowd, where now the crowd's just all caught up and the crowd's all around it and it's still doing the same thing. It's time for a bit of a freshen up and take it to another level.
Well, question for you, Akko. You mentioned just then the comparison that's it's got almost 500,000 views on YouTube. You basically took WRX STI head-to-head against the new GR Yaris. Let's pretend that Subaru tapped you on the shoulder and like 5 years ago and said, we're working on the new WRX STI. Here's the current one. Knowing what you know now about the performance compared to the Yaris, for example, what would you change with the STI from its current base?
I don't think it's from an engine point of view, I don't think it's capacity. I think it's so we don't need a bigger engine, but we want for me it needs more for the amount of grip and the amount of weight that it's got. Needs a lot more power and torque, and probably more even torque, to be honest. I think I'd focus on weight savings at the same time to be more nimble and agile like it was before. I would push the boundaries further balance wise. They've always been very conservative, especially a lot of Japanese car companies are, but like to an understeering balance. So they don't take the risk. They sort of like dull that out of the car. Where it's funny, I've seen a philosophy, especially with BMW actually, and it's probably too far, but where they've made these cars super oversteering, and then let the electronics save you. So you turn the traction control and stability control off, and they're actually massively oversteered cars, but it makes them feel really pointy and sharp to drive. The Subaru just naturally understeers it. There's no point to even switch traction control on or stability control on the cars, unless you completely mess things up. The car's going to pretty much stay pretty connected and on the road. And I think they need to, I would have said, take more risks with your balance, make it more reactive, look at saving weight over, say, putting a bigger engine in or something. Save weight and push the boundaries of that that boxer engine a bit further. And also, I think they need cool, like clever differentials, something that differentiates them from it actually comes from their motorsport background. Take things, more things from motorsport, because this was the start of the WRC cars back in the late 90s. This was leavened the evolution of the active diff cars, things like that. And although it's probably not viable financially, like to have some sort of control over more control over the three differentials, active pots, things like this, like really make it feel like a race car, where it doesn't feel like that at the moment. And like I drove the new M4 the other day, and you could adjust the traction control and do all this stuff. And that's what the WRX needs to be. It's coming from racing heritage. Like, so I would have really tried to embody the motorsport side of things, I think, a bit more and really connect that, because that's all it is. If you take it back and go back 25 years, it's just the same as the rally cars were back then. They were like three mechanical differentials and 2-liter turbo and all drive, and they weren't far away from you just turn that into a Group N car, and a Group A car wasn't far in front of that. So now in the future, where we've got a lot of other tools, and they actually haven't grabbed those motorsport tools and added them into the car.
I love that. Subaru are known to have like almost dozens of buttons on its steering wheel. Which buttons would you have on the STI wheel?
So I love the idea of like a traction control dial, something like that. We have similar things in a race car where we can control that. Same with, say, a launch control dial where you can control the revs. I know some cars do something like that, but I'm just going for things that I have in a race car. That's what I want in something like a WRX. So that would be ideal. And almost like a balance. I know you can do it with the controller in the center of the car, but yeah, a diff controlling balance where you can dial that back and forward as well. So move that all. And we did it in the WRC days. We used to have all the pots, we called them, down in the center of the car. So we'd have six pots. There were, say, 20 controls for the differentials. We could have active for the front, center, and rear. Then you could have the active slip control where it catches the slip. Then you can have the preload and the overall locking and everything. So we'd pick our six that we wanted, and we'd have them in the center of the car, and we'd dial them. So as the tires went off in the front, then you could wind some center diff in or a little more front diff and catch it early with the preload. Or if you're looking to catch slip, you could do all these things. Now that's way beyond what you need in a road car, but I think something that mimics the sense of that, where and it's more than achievable from an engineering standpoint. Like, I think it's not a tricky thing to actually do, and I think it would engage with the driver a lot more. So things like that, so traction control and things that you control the driving status of the car, put them on the wheel. And same with like I like the M buttons where you can select, like you can preset things and just set them on the wheel. I think those sort of things are good. And I like having like the in the Mercedes as well, it's really good with the little dial. And I think Porsche do it as well, where you can just dial through your settings on the wheel. Like, I see no reason why most of those driving aids in all these performance cars shouldn't be on the wheel. Like, I think that's, you want to have your hands on the wheel, and as a driver, then just adjust them on the wheel, not be looking down in the center console.
Hmm. Very, very true. Lastly, a bit of a geeky question. What colour would you have it?
I've driven a lot of blue ones, that's for sure. I actually was at the launch of the S209 in America a couple of years ago now, and I actually preferred the look of the white with the gold wheels at the time. It actually looked really clean and sharp. Nice. And out of the two at the time, I thought the white one looked pretty nice.
Yeah, nice choice.
There we go.
Keep your eye on carexpert.com.au. ADCO's full little, I don't know what you'd call it, report, opinion, story will be up at the site very soon. Thank you, ADCO.
My pleasure. Good to catch up with you all.
Well, we know for a fact fuel quality in Australia certainly isn't on par with the likes of Europe and other places around the world. Will, you've looked into this further, so I think it's probably worthy of a discussion. The story is live now. Why is Australia missing out on all the good stuff?
Well, look, it's best to look at the fuel standards that we actually have here. So I thought I'd just put together this article about what our fuel standards are at the moment, what the Australian government has announced, and how things are going to be changing. So basically, earlier this year, the Australian government announced that it was going to effectively help prop up the last two oil refineries in Australia. So we used to have about as recently as around 20 years ago, we had about 8 oil refineries. Now we're down to 2. So the Australian government put together this $2.3 billion package to keep those refineries open through 2030. But in exchange for that, those facilities have to start producing ultra-low sulfur petrol by the end of 2024. The Australian government is helping with that, though. The refineries are going to receive up to $125 million to upgrade their facilities. Now, it's really interesting to look at, if we just look at sulfur content to begin with, that's just one aspect of how clean or how good or how high quality fuel is. But our diesel fuel since 2009, it's been limited to 10 parts per million sulfur. But if you look at the regulations, 91 RON regular unleaded must contain no more than 150 parts per million sulfur, and 95 RON and 98 RON must contain no more than 50 parts per million sulfur.
Oh, what does that mean? That's nonsense.
Well, if you actually look over at Europe, for example, and their Euro 6 emission standards, they call for no more than 10 parts per million sulfur for all fuels. So if we just look at that,
wow.
their petrol has no more than 10 parts per million sulfur, whereas ours can have upwards of 150. So that's just looking at sulfur content alone. So it means that our sulfur content is higher than places like China. It's places higher than places like India, the US, New Zealand, which actually still has a single oil refinery over there. It does mean that our fuel is slightly cleaner than the likes of, I believe, South Africa and Indonesia. Sulfur content in our petrol is higher than countries like Morocco and Mexico. So that might come as a little bit of a surprise to some people, or perhaps it doesn't.
Well, Will, can I just quickly say that my memories of fuel in Indonesia was when I was in Bali and they were selling it on the side of the road out of a jar. So it is nice that our fuel quality is marginally better than fuel sold out of a jar on a street.
Good.
That's good to know. the maximum sulfur limits, and there's a really lovely chart that I found that you can see in the article that shows a map of the world and where the sulfur limits in each different country. And it says here, I believe Indonesia, 151 to 500 parts per million sulfur. So, yeah, a little bit dirtier than ours.
Wow.
And we don't sell ours in jars. So
that's a real shame.
So what does this mean for our car engine then?
It means that because our fuel is kind of, you know, crap, we miss out on stuff. So it's also important to note that sulfur content isn't the only thing. Our fuel has got more aromatics in it. So that's just something that's there to kind of boost the octane. It's got a maximum aromatic content that's higher than places like Europe. But the silver lining to this is our fuel is cheap, So of the 38 OECD countries, we had the fifth cheapest petrol and sixth cheapest diesel fuel in September 2020, according to the Australian Institute of Petroleum. So there is kind of a payoff there. And I think if you've traveled, remember travel, what's that? you would see that, you know, we do have, as much as we grumble about it sometimes, we do often have cheaper fuel than other places in the world. Maybe not Indonesia.
The jars are expensive.
So to answer your question though, Mandy, it does mean that we miss out on something. So if we look at one kind of practical example, the Volkswagen Group doesn't bring various vehicles here with petrol particulate filters. It's brought some vehicles over here with PPFs where they're like a more low volume model. So like an Audi RS3 or a Skoda Superb Scout. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you were to bring a car over here that had a PPF and you were to go put in regular unleaded fuel instead of premium unleaded fuel, which is still obviously dirtier than it is in Europe, the highest sulfur content of the fuel can clog the petrol particulate filter, which can, in layman's terms, mess up your car. So not a great thing. So, yeah, basically companies are... I mean, if you want to kind of summarize this, companies aren't bringing a lot of their newest engines because, unfortunately, we just don't have good enough fuel.
That's a shame. Could you imagine?
Yeah, it's really bloody disappointing, actually. It's it kind of annoys me that we're so far behind the times and we've just become a dumping ground for, you know, to be honest, pretty shitty engines.
And what's also interesting is there's all this talk about, you know, that we still have two oil refineries and we're going to be supporting them to 2030. And we're setting up, the Australian government's announced this variable fuel security services payment to basically, you know, pay to keep the lights on of these refineries. But we actually import around 90% of our liquid fuels. So the vast majority of fuel that, you know, you are using to fill up your car is coming from overseas anyway.
Interesting. All right. Now we're going to move on to another topic, another one that you've also researched, Will. Manual transmissions. They're a bit of a dying breed in new cars, but there's still some that you can buy that has that extra pedal on the floor. But I'm assuming the majority of them are probably going to be in sports cars.
Oh, well, there's a mix. So what I've done for this article, which will be live, this should be live by the time y'all are hearing this, is put together a list of the cars and SUVs you can still buy with a manual transmission. So I didn't look at utes and vans just because manual transmissions are still quite common there. That said, I actually did get some data, perhaps for a future article, on just how many utes are sold with manual transmissions, and it's really not as much as it used to be. And we are seeing a lot of like kind of high end utes, like your top spec Hiluxes and Rangers, aren't available with manual transmissions anymore. But I thought for this article, let's just look at cars and SUVs. And I thought for this podcast segment, Mandy, we might play a little game, which I know we've done before. So I've reached out to different manufacturers just to find out, you know, the percentage of their cars that they sell that have manual transmissions. So I want to put this to you both. What percentage, so for the first, for year to date 2021, what percentage of Mazda 2 sales overall are of, and keep in mind, this is one of the more affordable cars in the market. It's a segment that's traditionally manuals have been quite popular with. I'm not trying to give away the answer here, but what percentage of overall Mazda 2 sales this year do you think have been of a manual equipped model?
Oh, I might say 20%.
I'll go 40.
Oh.
We're way off, are we?
0.9%.
Wow.
Really? Yeah.
That's like, what, one?
Yeah. So wow. A greater percentage of Mazda CX-5 sales were of a manual-equipped model.
Wow. Oh my God.
One thing I noticed when putting together this article, there's a surprising number of midsize SUVs you can still buy with a manual transmission, but it's only ever in the base model. It's pretty much there as a, oh, look, you can get this one for this price, and they'll probably try to upsell you to one with an auto.
But there's a surprising number of them out there, and I dare say that they are going to disappear because we haven't got confirmation of the engine and the powertrain lineups for the likes of the upcoming Outlander Sportage X-Trail, but I will bet dollars to donuts none of them will come with a manual transmission. Toyota has said that they just discontinued the manual Corolla and Yaris. Like, that's, let that sink in for a second. You cannot buy a manual Corolla or Yaris anymore, unless it's a GR Yaris, but obviously that's a different thing. You can still buy a manual RAV4, but it accounts for less than 1% of sales.
It just shows you that these are literally price leaders so that they can con you into coming into the dealership and going, oh, well, I don't want the manual. And they go, oh, well, that's $3,000 extra.
I don't know if it's like people maybe like Google something and it says like the Toyota RAV4 priced from X. So they're like, yeah. Oh, cool. And then you go in and it's like, well, that's the GX manual, but check out this Cruiser hybrid here. But I mean, look, I totally get it. And car companies have been doing that for many, many, many years. But I thought, okay, so these are the mainstream offerings here. If we look at something perhaps a little bit more enthusiast-focused, what percentage of, let's do another Mazda, what percentage of MX-5 sales do you think are of the manual?
Oh,
surely that's like 60 or 70%.
I was going to say 50, yeah.
Mandy, you're closest. 49.7% this year.
Wow.
So that was actually one of the higher ones.
My faith has been restored.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. Oh, please, please let that be a relatively high percentage. If you look over at Porsche, for example, they say about half of their six-cylinder 718 series sales and about 50% of their 911 GT3 sales are of a manual.
So that surprises me. I would have thought most of those would be auto.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. If you look at the four-cylinder Boxster and Cayman models, that's around 5% of sales are manual. So
that kind of doesn't surprise
me. That didn't surprise me at all. this was a lot of fun to put together, just getting all the figures from companies that were able to give me the figures. Mazda really delivered because they gave me just this amazing spreadsheet. I was just nerding out over it. Tell me what percentage of Mazda 3 sedan, what percentage of Mazda 3 sales are sedan versus hatch, and all of that. So that was great. So thanks to Mazda for giving me that information. But yeah, look, a lot of these manual options are just going to disappear. They're going to disappear quite quickly, I dare say, because we've got the market is becoming increasingly electrified. Obviously, Australia electric vehicle sales are still very low, but we know that that is going to increase with time. And nobody's really been able to do a manual transmission with an electric vehicle yet, well, at least not an electric production vehicle. And I'm not sure if there's really any demand for that. And it is really unfortunate because I get why people buy. I mean, like what? I can talk. I drive a freaking auto. And the last few cars I've driven have been autos. I have fond memories I have fond memories of having owned manual equipped vehicles, but when push comes to shove, you know, when I'm buying a car to commute in, I've just pretty much gravitated over towards autos, and I would probably only consider a manual vehicle for like a weekend car. So yes, it is sad to see it disappearing. It is also sad to see you know, people. I think when I got my license, I got my learners the first day I legally could, and I got my peers the second day I legally could, only because I couldn't get it the first day I legally could. I insisted on getting a manual license because I just wanted to have that option. You know, I was then licensed to drive a manual, and I was licensed to drive an auto as well. But a lot of people are just, you know, just getting an auto license because what's the point? They might not ever drive a manual. And
it's such
I'm
a
not-
safer option though to get a manual. Like what if you're in some emergency situation and your friend or partner or whatever is, I don't know, cut his hand off and you've got to drive him to the hospital and he owns a manual transmission car, you know.
Well, I'm sure while he's bleeding from his stump, he'll be able to direct you through to how to use the clutch pedal. What a dire example.
Maybe that's so silly. Just get another partner.
No, the answer to that question is, Mandy, you call an Uber. And hope they don't charge you the cleaning fee.
This is very dark.
Yes, and how well it has. But yeah, look, it's sad to see manuals kind of go. But I don't want to say that every manual is good, because I've driven some manuals that have been rubbish. I've driven some autos that have been rubbish too. But not every manual transmission is a good one. But it will still be sad to see them, you know, slowly disappear. Even in your, like, you can't buy, right now, you can't buy a manual Ferrari or Lamborghini. You know, that's just that part of the market has just moved on from that, for better or worse. BMW still has 3 manual equipped models, M2, M3, M4, fantastic. But they don't actually account for M2, actually, they account for a good amount of sales, but they don't really for the M3 and M4. Mercedes-AMG, you can't get any manual equipped Mercedes AMG model. So it's whole swaths of the market have just moved away. So as I say in my article, I think we're going to get to a point where in a few years' time, all of these entry-level manual midsize SUVs that nobody buys and dealers don't stock, they'll be gone. Your light cars might not even have a manual anymore, because what's the best-selling light car in Australia? MG3. What are they marketed as? MG3 Auto. Why is that? Because it doesn't have a manual. So we're going to probably get to a point where we'll be down to like the last few manual cars, and they're going to be things like your MX-5s, your 86s, your Nissan Zeds, because, yeah, everyone else will have just kind of moved on. So a bit sad.
Yeah. It is. If you have any thoughts of this topic, you can email podcast at carexpert.com.au. That's an end to this week's podcast. Will, what cars have you got coming up in the Brisbane garage next week?
Yes. So right now I've got a Hyundai Tucson Highlander 1.6 litre turbo. So quite a bit of a better engine than the last Tucson I drove. Also getting behind the wheel of a Suzuki Vitara turbo. Next week, something a little bit more exciting, Jeep Gladiator Rubicon. So cool. If weather permits, and maybe if weather doesn't, I will be taking that
all
to...
All lockdown permits.
Yeah. Well, we're fine up here. Touch wood.
Jinx. I won't jinx you.
This desk is certainly not wood. But, yeah, I'll be taking that Gladiator off-roads. It's been a little while since I've gone off-roading. So
seeing a few of them getting around now, those Gladiators.
Yeah, well, too. They're pretty hard to miss.
But they really are.
Yeah, oh, did you see
the whole road?
Yeah. They've reintroduced a new color, and I know Stellantis' American brands love to introduce cool colors, but you can now get a hot pink Wrangler in the US.
Oh, that's what? A hard pass.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm not a fan of pink, not because it's a girl's color. I just don't like it. But
I can so totally see the fluffy pink steering wheel, mud flaps, the Barbie pink retro plate, all that.
My friend has got a previous generation Wrangler, and I showed him when I had the new Wrangler quite recently. I showed it to him. And he said, I don't like it. It looks like a Barbie car. And I'm like, it looks like the old Wrangler. What? But it's, I guess, it's a little bit softer. So I think, yeah, it could pink could work for it.
That is funny. Then it's a real Barbie car.
Yeah. And what cars have we got coming up in the Sydney office, Paul? There's not much happening in Melbourne at the moment.
Yeah, so we've got the new Q5, Kia Rio GT line, Defender 90, another crack at that, and the Stelvio Veloce. It is worth pointing out as well, a lot of people have asked, where are our GV70 and our i30N DCT reviews? Look, we've chosen not to test cars out of Melbourne just for the moment. Yes, we are allowed to do it, but... I don't know, to be honest, it's just an image thing. Like we, at the start of our snap 7-day lockdown, which has become like a 3-week lockdown, we were doing some stuff with a pair of 911 turbos, and we were able to return one of them, but the other one we didn't get back in time, and it's literally sat in my garage for 2.5 weeks now. And I don't want to be the guy that's out there driving that while everyone else in Melbourne is stuck at home and not allowed to go further than 5Ks. So just out of respect to everyone, we're just hanging 10 on reviews. And that means that stuff like GV70, i30N, DCT, those reviews will come eventually, but it'll be after our lockdown lifts in Melbourne where we can get access to the video team again and sort of make it all happen. So, that's why Melbourne is quiet.
How are the Sydney guys testing cars then? I'm assuming restrictions are a little bit more ease than in Melbourne?
Yeah, Sydney's interesting. They still have a condition on their lockdown that you can leave home if you can't work from home. So it kind of covers off that thing. We can organise permits for the guys here in Melbourne, but again, it's just very much a grey area and you don't want to be on the side of the road arguing with a police officer in your 911 turbo trying to convince him that what you're doing is so important that you must be outside. So, yeah, it's just one of those things that we're sort of playing it by ear at the moment.
Just means more reviews for me to do, although unfortunately no 9/11s to review.
You wouldn't like it, Will.
Oh, I'm sure.
You just stick in your little Vitara turbo, you'll be fine.
Yeah, yes. I'll tell myself that when I'm driving it. Like,
oh, no. Your pink gladiator.
Oh, God. William Stockford and Paul Marrick, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.